This is exactly right.
Hi, I'm Erin Welsh.
And I'm Erin Alman Updike, and we're the hosts of This Podcast Will Kill You on Exactly Right.
We're back with our seventh season, which is bigger and better than ever.
Because guess what? We're now a weekly show.
This season, we're tackling everything from long COVID to norovirus, from the supplement industry to IVF, and so, so much more.
New episodes drop every single Tuesday.
Follow This Podcast Will Kill You wherever you get your podcasts.
Chisel raised his sword and leaned across and ran Routledge through the heart, and immediately said he deserved his fate. I aimed for his heart and I hit it, and then asked for his slave boy to clean the sword, and he then ordered some toddy and sat down and drank. I mean, just unbelievable, that scene. And the feeling of utter righteousness on his part, that he wronged me verbally and I've put that right. And in front of many, many witnesses, it must have been an incredible and ghastly spectacle.
It was June of 1766, more than a week after Colonel John Chisel stabbed Scottish merchant Robert Routledge to death with his sword. The sheriff drove Chisel toward Williamsburg, about 100 miles away, which would have taken at least a day. Having spent a week locked away in the Cumberland County Jail, Chisel was exhausted. He had been dragged to court, and he had demanded that the justices release him on bail so he could avoid the spectacle of being jailed in Williamsburg, where his family lived. But the justices had declined to offer bail. Murderers were virtually never offered bail, no matter their status. The judges were also likely nervous about the case, so they sent Chisel to Williamsburg to appear before the general court. Historian and interpreter Nicole Brown explains what happened as Chisel's carriage rambled along the country road.
So he's on his way to Williamsburg, and all of a sudden, the sheriff in question is intercepted by several gentlemen of Williamsburg, also including his attorney, John Wales.
John Wales was a terrible person. Let's just say that up front. He was a plantation owner and a slave trader. He was also a lawyer, and he was connected to a future president, Thomas Jefferson, because Jefferson had married Wales's daughter, Martha. John Wales was not a good person, but he was a good attorney.
He's an attorney at this time, and not a very popular one by all accounts in the newspaper, but he ends up being Colonel Chisel's attorney and either takes depositions or the depositions from the individuals in the tavern are collected by him to be brought in front of three of the justices of the peace.
Let's go back a bit for some context. While Chisel was in jail in Cumberland County, Wales had been gathering information about his case. What exactly had happened that afternoon in Mosby's Tavern? Who saw what, and what exactly do they think they saw? Once it seemed like there could be room for reasonable doubt, Wales came up with a defense. Routledge had threatened Chisel. Chisel armed himself with a long sword, then Routledge lunged forward and essentially threw himself on the sword, killing himself accidentally. To Wales, this seemed like a reasonable explanation. Wales also knew that it would be unacceptable for a member of the gentry class to be jailed in the center of Williamsburg. It would be humiliating, not just for Chisel, but for any member of the upper class in the 13 colonies. So Wales approached the three justices of the general court in Williamsburg. This was the highest court for the colony of Virginia. It was meant to preside over felony cases or civil cases that were financially more notable. Big cases. These three men would be presiding over Chisel's case, and they would decide if John Chisel would receive bail.
These individuals are all appointed to serve for life
by the crown. The royal governor is coming from England or Scotland, so he's not going to be familiar with the customs and the traditions of the Virginians. And that's why the crown has appointed these Virginians, for the most part native-born Virginians, to assist the governor with his responsibilities. They serve as the upper house of the colony's legislature, they serve as the executive administration for the colony's government, and they serve as the justices in the highest court in the colony.
So three men from the governor's council. It's John Blair, Presley Thornton, and William Byrd III, who we made mention of earlier.
You've heard of William Byrd III because he was a business partner of Chisel and John Robinson. The three men owned Chisel's lead mine. John Chisel also owed William Byrd some money, and Byrd had borrowed money from John Robinson. Now you see how things went in the colonies.
The gentry, the good old boy system, and they were all partners.
Chisel's lawyer, John Wales, approached the three justices of the general court and explained what happened in the tavern that day. The trio of men panicked. They all had personal connections to Chisel, and it would certainly be detrimental to the gentry class to have one of their own seen behind bars in the center of town. So while Chisel was at a bail hearing in Cumberland County, the three judges came up with a plan in Williamsburg.
Let's go talk to these three attorneys, one of whom is George Wythe, to see if he can find precedent to give Colonel Chisel bail.
The justices of the general court were searching for a legal way to justify giving John Chisel bail.
They approach some learned lawyers, one of whom is George Wythe, to ask if it was possible for Colonel Chisel to receive bail.
That's incredible. The judges of the general court were supposed to remain unbiased, but they weren't. They knew it would be detrimental to send another member of the gentry class to jail, but it wasn't just Chisel's reputation that was at stake. Let's talk about what Chisel would face if he were locked up in Williamsburg, and public humiliation would be the least of his troubles.
Lots of photos, ladies, okay?
Yeah. You'd like you could get a picture of one of y'all unlocking it.
Oh, why don't you do that? Get the key. It's a weird key.
Thanks, Cash.
I got the key.
So the lock is pretty finicky.
Cash Earhart and Nicole were kind enough to give my daughters and me a tour of the jail where Chisel would serve his time.
There we go. All right, now turn it counterclockwise. Yep, keep going. All right.
There you go.
I'll go in first, Mom.
Thank you.
Is this a jail cell?
No, why doesn't Cash explain that to you, what this actually is?
So right now, we are in the jail keeper's living quarters. This is where the jail keeper and his family would have resided. There would have had a kitchen on site as well, and probably some other living space also. So it's a pretty comfortable space compared to what most Virginians would reside in. Most Virginians, free or enslaved, they probably live in a structure that has a dirt floor, no glass in the windows. It would have an earthen fireplace, whereas this structure, it has a wooden floor. It's a brick building on a raised foundation. It has glazed windows. And the fact that it has multiple rooms is another benefit.
It was an important job that required the jailer to stay on the premises most of the time, so it makes sense that the quarters would be nice, but we were curious about what it would be like for a prisoner.
So I know the night before his trial was to commence, Chisel was supposed to stay in the jail. Do you have any idea of what cell he likely would have stayed in?
They don't seem to have had assigned jail cells.
Perhaps John Chisel would eventually be taken to the gallows. Certainly at that time, the public seemed to support the idea that a murderer deserved it. But first, he'd need to go on trial, and he'd have to spend some time in one of those cells.
They're pretty Spartan conditions. You would not have had furniture in the cells. You would have had a couple of pallets that's sort of like a cloth bag that's been filled with straw or
corn husks to sleep on. The jailkeeper is responsible for providing you food and for keeping you healthy. But if you wanted better treatment or better food or furniture or lodging, you could have it, but only if you could afford to pay for it.
Like so much of society at that time, even in jail, it paid to be a member of the gentry.
Did the gentry, like Chisel, know about all of these conditions?
Oh, absolutely. Chisel's son-in-law is the Speaker of the House. His friends serve on the council, who are the justices of the court. So he would be very familiar with the circumstances that folks in the jail are staying in.
As far as you know, in the history of this jail in Williamsburg, had anybody at his caliber had been here for any reason, debtors or anything else?
There were instances previously where individuals in high station in society had gotten in trouble with the law, but I'm not aware of anyone that had ever progressed to the point of about to be kept in the jail under the accusation of murder.
Jail was a perilous place, and anyone who spent time there was likely at risk, no matter their social status, or maybe especially at risk because of it.
The public jail that you've been in is the place where anybody who committed a murder is to be held before their trial. And I certainly cannot think of anybody who received the privilege of getting to go back to his own house to await trial.
But Chisel's attorneys, including George Wythe, did find that precedent. He pointed to a murder case where the coroner had not declared that the death was a murder at the inquest. Remember that in Rutledge's case, the coroner had said that he had died from a sword stabbing, but Chisel was not named.
Then Colonel Chisel can receive bail. This man received bail because of a coroner's inquest.
They do find precedent to give Colonel Chisel bail, or the attorneys do, although it's dubious at best. And Colonel Chisel, rather than being ushered away to the jail in Williamsburg, which will be very hot and dark in the middle of the summer, is sent to his beautiful townhome in Williamsburg, two streets over.
The three judges, all friends of Chisel, convened privately after the attorneys presented their findings, and they made their decision. John Chisel could receive bail, and they were in the right, technically. Cash Earhart takes Nicole Brown and me on a tour of a historic building where the council had once met.
What sort of conversations would have taken place
in
this room after Colonel Byrd and the other members of the council pretty much took it upon themselves to secure
bail
for Chisel?
This seemed to be 18th century privilege on display, and Robert Rutledge was essentially dismissed as a victim whose life had little value. Instead, Rutledge's position as a merchant was threatening.
We're talking about somebody who outright murdered his friend, and then his friends tried to give him a privileged position.
So these two guys, when we talk about Colonel Chisel, who of course is an aristocrat's aristocrat, he is as gentry as they come. He is kind of a jerk. No one seems to particularly care for the guy, but is wealthy, well-connected. And then you've got someone like Rutledge, who is making his way in the world in a time where people making their way in the world is making the wealthy elites uncomfortable.
Because they want things to stay the same.
Yeah, so we've got our status quo guy who's representing sort of old school. And then you've got Rutledge is sort of the people who are up and coming. And this bigger question always is who's in charge, who matters, and who gets to make those decisions?
The justices had never interviewed any of the witnesses themselves. They just accepted the legal advice. That day on the country ride, when the sheriff was stopped from continuing on to Williamsburg, the three judges, as well as Chisel's attorney, were there to offer Chisel bail and deliver him to his home. He thanked them for their assistance. But now he had to pay the bail. They couldn't release Chisel from that onerous obligation. And it was an incredibly large sum of money, a total of 6,000 pounds. That's more than $1.5 million in today's money.
2,000 pounds for himself, with four gentlemen vouching for him at 1,000 pounds each. 6,000 pounds! A wild amount of money. I mean, 1,000 pounds in Virginia for a working class person is considered an insurmountable debt. What?
He has to pay 2,000 and then he's got four other people paying 1,000 pounds each.
Mm-hmm.
And who are these other people? Gentry.
Gentrymen, his friends, who are doing what everyone else is doing, hence the credit society. It's the scratch of a pen.
Robert means that all five of these men, including Chisel, are just signing their name for credit and promising to pay the note someday.
They're not going back to a bank, right, and withdrawing 1,000 pounds. No, no. They are signing their name to a piece of paper, just like you do for many transactions, if not most transactions, in Virginia.
That was another good illustration of why the colonists in all 13 colonies were always in debt. It was so easy to borrow money at high interest rates. Regardless of the expense, John Chisel had avoided the jail for now, and for him, that was certainly worth the price. After Chisel headed home with his lawyers, Sheriff Jesse Thomas turned the carriage around and headed back west alone. In Williamsburg, Colonel Chisel's attorney, John Wales, and his colleagues began building their case for self-defense. The first part was picking a jury. It's the right of a defendant to be judged by a jury of his peers.
So since Colonel Chisel lives here in Williamsburg, but he's accused of murder out in Montgomery County, Virginia, near Blacksburg at Mosby's Tavern is where the crime took place, would Chisel object to having six jurors come from out west to come and sit on the jury here in Williamsburg? Because the idea is that who better to know whether or not someone might have committed a crime than that person's neighbors, someone who would be familiar with the circumstances
right.
of the crime.
Chisel was a resident of Williamsburg, so half of his jury would come from the countryside out west where he owns property, and the other half would come from where he lives most of the time. Here's the problem. The wealthy men from the countryside would also be unlikely to convict a member of the gentry. But in the city, a juror might be a middle-class person who would be less sympathetic.
But you're not likely to find some of the same sorts of gentlemen coming from out west as you would find impaneled on a jury here in Williamsburg.
And that revelation began to make people in Williamsburg very angry. A mysterious writer with the pen name D.K. Philos began submitting anonymous articles to the newspaper, the Virginia Gazette. D.K. Philos is the Greek phrase for lover of justice. The writer questioned the general court's decision to grant Chisel bail. They accused Chisel of being privileged, of taking advantage of his high station. The writer was concerned that justice would be derailed, that Chisel would get away with murder, that the jury would be tilted toward Chisel.
I'll just read a couple of lines from this D.K. Philos. He says, "Some persons have ungenerously surmised that the influence of Mr. Chisel's friends will prevent the truth from being published. But who of his friends have so little sense and honor as to desire the suppression of truth and the violation of justice and government?"
Suppression of truth. This phrase might not seem incendiary, but in the 18th century, it's a big accusation against the gentry.
He's not mincing words here, right? This is a different quote. He says, "Patriots, however, are alarmed on this occasion. Foreigners are alarmed. The middle and lower ranks of men who are acquainted with the particulars are extremely alarmed. But have they reason for much uneasiness? Ought they not to believe that the persons in power will always act rightly?"
A few weeks later, the lead justice, John Blair, responded to the accusations made by the anonymous writer in the newspaper. Blair had penned the reply earlier because he realized just how unpopular the court's decision was. Judge Blair said he believed it to be, quote, an unhappy, drunken affair, and so bail could be offered. It was not, Blair believed, murder. And he said that English judges were allowed to grant bail to murderers if they wished. And that argument goes back to the fundamental argument for liberty. We colonists no longer want to follow English law. Our system of government will be different. Politics was grafted onto crime once again. The government of Virginia was being called into question. Remember in the last episode when we talked about America's first murder diagram, the sketch that pinpointed each man's movement? It was Decay Phillos who drew up that map to be printed in the newspaper. Who was this anonymous writer? We don't know for sure. Some scholars have speculated that he was a printer with a grudge against the gentry. During our tour, Cash Earhart reveals the most popular theory.
And it was the Reverend Jonathan Boucher. That's what is suspected. And Boucher was the tutor of George Washington's stepson, John Park Custis.
If the author were really Reverend Jonathan Boucher, then that's a little surprising given his political leanings.
The interesting thing about Decephalos and those articles too, especially if it was Jonathan Boucher who wrote it, is, you know, in hindsight, everyone say, well, he's a loyalist. So you would think maybe he would side with that old guard as we perceive it. And yet he is the loudest protester of what's happening with the Chisel-Rutledge affair. Hmm. So I think it speaks to this idea of patriot and loyalist as right. We know them in the 1760s don't exist.
Right. I asked Cash what Boucher was hoping to accomplish by publishing the articles.
He sounds like someone who wants to see the world as he would wish it instead of the world as it is.
Right.
When this happens, he's publishing those articles under the name of Decephalus, pointing out the inconsistencies. This is wrong. You aren't supposed to grant someone bail. You know, the Crown's attorney, the Attorney General, he should have been here instead of being out of town when this is happening.
That's right. The Attorney General made sure he was out of town when the depositions were taken, and then when Chisel was granted bail. And here's why he left. The Attorney General's name was Peyton Randolph, Chisel's brother-in-law. Peyton was the brother of Chisel's wife, Elizabeth. Do you see now how well connected John Chisel was?
So you're beginning to see those fissures that I was talking about. The status quo is in danger. Yeah, the status quo is under siege.
These essays, purportedly from Reverend Boucher, were read by people of all classes across the 13 colonies and across the ocean in England.
The newspaper in Maryland picks up the entire story after it's published in the Virginia Gazette here in Williamsburg, and it would have not been unexpected that leaders throughout the different colonies subscribed to each colony's newspapers. Taverns also would often subscribe to newspapers from the different colonies. And it was a common practice to lift entirely what we would think of as copy and paste articles from other colonies' newspapers and published in yours. That way, these incidents would have become pretty well known pretty quickly throughout North America and ultimately back in London.
In 10 years, Thomas Paine would write the essay Common Sense. It was printed 500,000 times. In Common Sense, Paine argued for independence from England, and it alone convinced many colonists that it was time to be free from the king. Boucher and his articles were just as powerful as Thomas Paine and his essay. Finally, someone explained to the masses why John Robinson and John Chisel were the avatars for English greed in the colonies. The abundance of information about Rutledge's murder, as well as Chisel's privilege, caused incredibly vicious debates and accusations in the papers. Members of the old guard were actively attacking each other in print.
Everything's just bandied about in this messy, nasty, juicy kind of way, in the way that I think we all still relate to things with news, right? The dirtier it is or the messier it is, the faster we click on it, right? Same thing.
Right. Remember the name of this season, entitled... The theme of this season is someone with privilege in America escaping justice. It's something we debate in newspapers today, in the media. When is enough enough for a society? When do they stop being entitled and start being held accountable, regardless of their political affiliation? I often talk about how lessons resonate with people now, and I'm sure that this is one of those lessons. Tenfold More Wicked is sponsored in part by BetterHelp. Pondering time and its fleeting nature is a privilege and rite of passage. But if you're not careful, asking big philosophical questions can get overwhelming. Therapy helps you explore those big and little questions while learning more about yourself along the way. Don't just take my word for it. Find a therapist you can trust and who will help you face any question or challenge. BetterHelp is the place to start the journey. It's entirely online and created to fit into your busy schedule. A therapist is waiting to hear from you. Just fill out a brief questionnaire and you'll get matched with a licensed therapist. If it doesn't click between you two, you can switch therapists anytime and there's no additional charge. Full disclosure, I've been in therapy for years and I find it really helpful just to process things like my father's death, my stepmother's death, anything happening in my life, dealing with my kids, all of that can be addressed in therapy and it feels like such a safe environment. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/wicked today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp.com/wicked. Chances are, no matter who you are or what stage of your life you're in, someone special to you probably lives far away. Whether you're in a long-distance relationship, living a few states or a few hours away from your parents, or maintaining a cross-country friendship, Aura Frames is for you. Aura Frames are digital photo frames that make it easy for you to instantly display and share your favorite, funniest, or most important memories with your loved ones. Aura Frames make incredible gifts. They come with unlimited storage and simple controls, so you can share as many photos as you'd like and give others access to the easy-to-use Aura app so they can contribute as well. I've used my Aura Frame for years, and I like them so much that I actually give them out as gifts. They are the perfect gift, especially to close family members, because it's really easy for me to just upload pictures remotely, so I can surprise them with a new array of photos when they get home from work. It's been great to keep us connected. Right now, you can save on the perfect gift that keeps on giving by visiting AuraFrames.com. For a limited time, listeners can get $20 off their best-selling frames with code WICKED. That's AuraFrames.com, promo code WICKED. Terms and conditions apply. The colonists were incensed over the details about Chisel's threats towards Rutledge, especially his abusive language. And then Chisel claimed that Rutledge was the aggressor and that his death was a tragic accident. The public was incredulous, but of course, they never protested over the fact that Chisel threatened to kill his enslaved manservant just for refusing to bring him a sword.
When you look at the reports of this case, the depositions, what's in the newspaper, no one bats an eye about him threatening to kill his enslaved manservant. That level of violence is expected. So in that kind of world, where in Williamsburg, where he spends a great deal of time, over half the population is Black, the majority enslaved, and you have laws essentially saying that if you kill your enslaved individuals in the process of correction, it's not a felony, how much longer does it take until you start to escalate towards violence of other members of your community? It's a matter of time.
The enslaved manservant had been a witness. He had been standing right there when Rutledge was killed. He was friend to neither man. Perhaps he was an unbiased opinion that could be valuable in the murder case. No, said Virginia's government.
Would he have testified?
No, because no person of color is allowed to testify against a white person in a court of law in the 18th century. So this is...
Even if it doesn't affect them.
That's correct. Yeah.
Oh.
As the summer months waned and the autumn of 1766 approached, so did Colonel John Chisel's murder trial in Williamsburg. It was set to begin on August 16th, and John Chisel was very restless.
I think as we move further into this very hot, sticky summer, and we know it was a hot, sticky summer because of some of the other reports in the newspaper that year, along with his murder case. You know, they mention at one point in late July, beginning of August, he's come back from his lead mines.
Newspaper writers had followed Chisel since the story had broken. The papers reported that he had visited his lead mines in late July and at the beginning of August. Nicole Brown says that was outrageous. Why was he allowed to go anywhere?
So not only was he brought to Williamsburg and then given bail, he was allowed to go back out to the western part of Virginia to check his mines. And they said, well, we hope you just come back by October 16th when your trial is.
It was almost as if Chisel had been allowed to simply return to business as usual. John Chisel greeted his wife, Elizabeth, inside their home on East Francis Street. His bedrooms and dining room were filled with valuable objects that demonstrated his wealth and power. He had hosted some of the most important people in the colonies and England. They had dined on oysters, sheep's head, and curried chicken. Spices were a luxury good. They sipped chocolate drinks and told old stories over elaborate, multi-course meals. Chisel was free of shackles, but the working-class people in Williamsburg had heard that he was offered bail, and he took it. The people also remembered that Chisel's son-in-law, John Robinson, had stolen a fortune and caused Virginia to sink further into debt. Chisel had broken their trust. And all the while, the King of England was tightening his grip on the colonies. Parliament had taxed them. Their rights were being taken away. And now John Chisel had been released on bail by his powerful friends. He was free, and they were furious. People stalked his house, and those who protested his release were certain that he would get away with murder. John Chisel was free, but miserable. He still maintained that it was just an accident.
I mean, I think he's racked with guilt.
You do?
But whether it's entirely guilt for the murder or guilt for what he has done to his family's reputation.
Yeah.
I am not comfortable separating those strains of guilt, but I think they're interconnected and I don't know which one is stronger.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the really intriguing things about the history and getting all the pieces of information that other historians may want to say something more definitive than I'm saying. But that's, you know, that's interpretation. And that's part of why learning about the people, not just the dates, is intriguing to me.
Angry crowds gathered outside Chisel's large home in Williamsburg and demanded vengeance. He and his family could hear them outside as guards patrolled their property. Historian Robert Weathers says that the colonists were compelled to protest. They believed that it was the only way to force a change with the gentry.
Precedent needed to be found so that Colonel Chisel could be brought out on bail. And you see the dangerous, slippery slope effect that that actually can have, which is part of the reason why when you protest against the Stamp Act, you're doing so that it doesn't set a precedent.
Nicole Brown is sitting with us during my interview with Weathers.
And that's also why people get so upset with the Chisel-Rutledge murder, because if they don't protest it, it could become precedent that the elite basically can't be tried for murder.
In the newspapers, the anonymous writer D.K. Filos described the sentiment of most colonists, and it wasn't good. They say that one atrocious murder has already been cleared by means of great friends, and they are apprehensive that it will not be the last opprobrious stain of the kind in our colony. In other words, John Chisel was going to get away with murder. The anonymous writer also reported that a reliable source had confirmed that several witnesses at the tavern had been tampered with. The colonists in Williamsburg screamed that the law was being ignored. If one of them had murdered someone, they would have been hanged. Yet John Chisel was convinced that he would walk free, and so was much of the lower class. The writer explained in the newspapers, "Patriots are alarmed on this occasion. Foreigners are alarmed. The middle and lower ranks of men who are acquainted with the particulars are extremely alarmed." In Prince George County, where Robert Rutledge lived, there was outrage. While John Chisel sat comfortably at home, their friend was dead. They demanded his blood, an eye for an eye. The anonymous author pleaded with them in the newspapers to wait until the trial. Rutledge's friends agreed, but they made it clear in letters to the paper that they would seek revenge if Chisel were acquitted. Robert Rutledge's friends assumed that John Chisel was lounging at home with few worries because of his powerful friends, but that really wasn't true. John Chisel was extremely worried, and he couldn't bear to spend the rest of his life in prison. Mobs of people in Williamsburg wanted him hanged one way or the other. There would be no police protection, and he and his friends would be lynched if they were caught tampering with witnesses. But perhaps he might escape the gallows with attorneys who could prove it was an accident or self-defense. Or perhaps John Chisel and his family could simply disappear. It was a big new world with limited communication after all, and historian Nell Darby says people vanished all the time in the 18th century.
You know, men who deserted their wives, you know, they could quite happily go and disappear and start new lives afresh.
Julie Richter wonders about the expectations of both the gentry and the upper class in Virginia. After all, Colonel John Chisel was an honorable gentleman. Abandoning his family and leaving town would have been disgraceful.
There may have been a small bit of belief or maybe hope that he would do the honorable thing, that he would go home and then return for his trial, being a man who is, again, supposed to display honor in his actions and in his deeds and in his words. And if any of the men who agreed to bail did it believing that he would act honorably, disappointment against probably not a strong enough word, but they would have felt that he had violated the trust they placed in him.
Or perhaps something completely unplanned, even by him, might happen to John Chisel. He was fretful, concerned about jail, about a likely guilty verdict, and about the shame he had brought on his family, and he was in danger. So on June 23, 1766, Chisel sat down at his desk in Williamsburg and picked up a pen. He glanced over the paper as he wrote it. It was his last will and testament, and it included the most important asset in his name, his coveted business, the Lead Mining Company. The assets of the mining company included land, carts, wagons, utensils, and, not surprisingly, enslaved people. Chisel had a minority interest, and he was deeply in debt. He owed his partner, William Byrd III, £1,300, and he owed the estate of John Robinson more than £8,000. As he opened his desk drawer to secure the document, he thought carefully about the names of the people who had agreed to be his executors. There was Richard Randolph, his wife's cousin, who was a wealthy planter. He also named Charles Carter, a rich plantation owner who had married his daughter Elizabeth. But the final two executors were the interesting ones, William Byrd and Presley Thornton. These were two of the three justices of the general court who had granted him bail. Now, did this mean anything? At best, it seemed unethical. Even more importantly, their inclusion in his will illustrated the depth of their relationship with Chisel. Historian Carson Hudson says that the governor of the colony of Virginia was in a terrible position.
You know, what could the governor, and this is another person I would have hated to have been, was the governor. You know, what do you do? Because if the case comes to trial and you find him innocent, you're literally going to have riots in the colony. If you find him guilty, then that's going to make you and all your friends and buddies and all that look really, really bad. And that's going to lower the respect that the lower classes have of you.
So by the time we get to October, Colonel Chisel's case is supposed to occur on October 15th, 16th. And I cannot imagine the level of stress he was under or the level of stress the city was under. I can imagine that the tension was palpable. And in this muddy, messy, icky sort of October in Virginia, because having lived in Virginia, Octobers are sort of balmy sometimes, but often still atrociously humid. You have this palpable feeling in the air, I would imagine, of what is going to happen.
Chisel, no doubt, is well aware of the insult he's receiving in the newspapers.
So if he knew about financial problems after his son-in-law died, and you find out about the debt in addition to your finances, it's sort of like the self-performance has a lot of little elements, and debt and not being able to perform as an elite man is going to be a mental burden, an emotional burden.
Who would get justice, and who else would end up dead?
We can never really know. But when you look at all of these things compounding at the same time, in addition to the fact that he's being held accountable for them, I think that's where the stressor is.
On the final episode of this season of Tenfold More Wicked on Exactly Right.
To have a gentleman not just behave this way, but then the law bend in his favor is such a violation of trust.
Gentlemen don't do those things. And gentlemen are not found guilty of murdering peasants.
It is hard for me to overstate to you how important this individual decision is to the era of the American Revolution.
In some ways, I would liken it to the United States in 1968. There are these incidents that inspire individuals to protest.
To jump between what happens with the Stamp Act all the way to declaring independence is a cataclysmic shift. The only metaphor I can think of is if you're standing between two tectonic plates and they start shifting.
If you love a good, real ghost story, my audiobook, The Ghost Club, is available on Audible now. I can't wait to tell you the real story about the world's most famous ghost hunter, who was the head of the world's most famous ghost club, and how he investigated England's most famous haunted house. Please also check out my books, American Sherlock and All That Is Wicked. This has been an Exactly Right Tenfold More Media production. Producer Jason Whaling, Senior Producer Alexis Amorosi, Consulting Producer Kyle Ryan, Researcher Nicole Brown, Sound Designer Eric Friend, Composer Curtis Heath, Artwork Nick Toga, Executive Producers Georgia Hardstark, Karen Kilgariff, and Danielle Kramer. Follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Tenfold More Wicked and on Twitter at Tenfold More.